Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. urscorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, Facebook versus Google, how a battle of social media titans is unfolding in Silicon Valley. And Cruz Reynoso, the son of farm workers who became the first Latino justice on the California Supreme Court, a new documentary highlights his legal career, including a battle with Ronald Reagan.
We had brought a case against local school districts because they had closed down the schools because the growers needed more workers at that time. And so we were now, according to Reagan, destroying agriculture.
And how a new music director is shaking up a Bay Area orchestra on its 20th anniversary.
We actually have more fun because before I felt like we were a classical ensemble. It should be called the Wild New Century Chamber Orchestra or the Endless Possibility because there's so much. She thinks way out of the box. She thinks world.
It's the California Report. Well, Silicon Valley is all about change, and there was plenty of that and more in the tech world this week. At Hewlett-Packard, Leo Apotheker is out after less than a year on the job, and Meg Whitman is in as CEO of the floundering company. And at a conference in San Francisco Thursday, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg rolled out huge changes to the world's largest social networking site, including a feature called Timeline. It's a kind of digital scrapbook that Zuckerberg described this way.
We wanted to design a place that feels like your home. Where you tell your story online is really personal. You invest a lot of time in it and you curate it. You link to it and you tell all your friends to find you there. So we wanted to make Timeline a place that you're proud to call your home.
And here with us now to talk about all that and more, Dylan Tweeney. He's executive editor of VentureBeat, a tech business news site based here in San Francisco. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Facebook. Dylan Zuckerberg rolling out those features this week. He says it's just to allow friends to more seamlessly interact with each other. What's your take on the changes that are coming?
Well, the thing that's going to be most visible to people right off is the timeline, which is basically an enhanced profile page so that when you see everything about you, instead of being this sort of boxy kind of thing that it used to be, it's now a chronological timeline. And I think actually this is the most interesting and kind of exciting thing that they've changed from a user point of view. Okay, because, you know, it used to be that you would put stuff on Facebook, photos or likes or whatever, people would wish you happy birthday, and then it would just kind of scroll off and be lost forever.
Disappear.
Yeah. You knew it was on Facebook server somewhere, but there was no way to get to it easily. And Timeline is actually really interestingly laid out and lets you kind of scroll back through the years all the way back to the beginning of time.
All right. Well, let's talk about the other feature that Zuckerberg rolled out this week. It's these lifestyle apps that are going to allow users to share information about their activities, what their music they're listening to, movies they're watching. And again, let's hear Mark Zuckerberg describe it at this conference.
There are apps for helping you keep track of and expressing all kinds of different things about your life, your runs, your bike rides, your cooking and eating, your sleeping, your happiness, your fashion, anything you want.
Dylan Tweeney, again, making it sound like this is really about the user, but there's, I suspect, some profits to be made in all this for Facebook, right?
Right. So, okay, so these lifestyle apps are part of a bigger kind of open graph, is the way Zuckerberg described it. It's sort of this platform for building apps that take advantage of all kinds of things. So people can build apps that do things like, you know, help you track your runs, but also share music with people or recommend movies. Or say, I just bought a ticket to a concert and now I'm attending this concert. So the people who build those apps, yes, there's all kinds of chances to make money.
Ticketmaster, for example.
Exactly, yeah. And Spotify is providing music and Netflix, movies. So these companies obviously are in it to make money, and Facebook is going to take a percentage.
And do you think that our users are pretty savvy? Are they going to feel taken advantage of, do you think, if it gets to the point where really all this information, of course, it's happening already all around us on other sites as well, but where this information that we think of as very personal info that we're sharing with our friends is going to really be used to sell us stuff?
Well, I feel a little weird about that. And I think, a lot of people kind of in Silicon Valley who are very conscious of these kinds of issues spend time thinking about that. But I think the average Facebook user probably doesn't care all that much. I mean, Facebook has done a really good job of delivering things to people that they want. And they've been very cautious about sort of blatantly monetizing that. And in fact, the times that they have done that, like this beacon feature that they rolled out a couple of years ago, people were very outraged about, and so they rolled it back. So Facebook is proceeding very cautiously in making money off its users, and I think to the extent that they do it, most people really don't care.
Talk about the timing of this, because Google, of course, a few months ago rolled out Google Plus, which is sort of the big Battle of the Titan competition with Facebook. It has relatively few users right now, maybe, I think, what, 10 to 20 million, something
like that.
Yeah,
we don't know exactly.
We don't know exactly. Is there a chance that with all these changes right now that Facebook is going to be rolling out that people are going to say, maybe it's a good time to check out Google Plus?
Yeah, there's always that danger with a social network. I mean, and you don't ever want to bet against Google, right? They obviously have lots of talent and they already have huge reach through their search engine and through their other products. But Facebook has an enormous, enormous advantage here in that they've been around for a while. They've had a lot of practice rolling out new features. They have 800 million users. I mean, they're huge. So, we've seen social networks come and go. They can make bad decisions, and then all of a sudden everybody decides the party is somewhere else. And I think Google's best chance is for something like that to happen.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the other big story from Silicon Valley. Hewlett-Packard, the iconic Silicon Valley company, struggling, naming Meg Whitman as CEO, replacing Leo Apotheker. She was kind of a celebrity CEO in Whitman, having been from eBay and now, of course, coming off of a failed run for governor. What do you think of that choice?
I think Whitman is a great choice, if only because they need somebody who's going to be a strong leader and who knows how to communicate clearly and kind of set things to rights. The problem is that Whitman has never run a company of this size. eBay was, I think, a 14th the size of HP in terms of revenues. And I think the board is still very confused about what exactly they want.
Is the problem fundamentally bad management? Is it just market changes that HP hasn't adjusted to? Is it a flawed business strategy? I mean, is it something that a new CEO, a great CEO, if Whitman turns out to be that, can fix?
Possibly. I think it actually goes back to the board. I think they have been indecisive. They were too quick in firing Mark Hurd a couple of years. Well, not even a couple of years ago, right? And I think they picked Leo Apotheker way too quickly. None of the board members actually interviewed him face-to-face, the New York Times was reporting earlier this week. I think they've just made a series of bad decisions. And the results of that have been enormous damage to HP as a company. Whether Whitman can pull the company out of that kind of tailspin, I don't know.
Well, it certainly gives her a chance to write a new chapter
in
her life after that disastrous run for governor.
Yes, exactly.
Dylan Tweeney, executive editor of VentureBeat, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
For the past two decades, the California Supreme Court has been a model of racial and gender diversity on the bench. But it wasn't always that way. In 1982, Cruz Reynoso, the son of farm workers, became the court's first Latino justice when he was chosen by Governor Jerry Brown. Reynoso was later recalled by voters in a campaign mostly aimed at Chief Justice Rose Byrd. Reynoso earned his reputation as Director of California Rural Legal Assistance, or CRLA, which advocates for the rural poor. His life is the subject of a new documentary by filmmaker Abby Ginsberg. In this clip from the film, Reynoso is battling with then-Governor Ronald Reagan, who wanted to eliminate funding for CRLA.
We think that it's gone a little afield in which it's kind of become a promoter of social causes.
Reagan always hated CRLA. He accused us of undermining democracy. we had brought a case against local school districts because they had closed down the schools because the growers needed more workers at that time. And so we were now, according to Reagan, destroying agriculture.
He determines that the program is not beneficial to the people and is not fulfilling its original purpose.
I see here a deliberate attempt, a scheme, if you will, on the part of the governor to sabotage CRLA and legal services.
And of course, CRLA did go on to win that argument with Ronald Reagan. And Abby Ginsberg, one of the other people Cruz Reynoso battled with was someone you wouldn't expect, and that was Cesar Chavez, the head of the United Farm Workers. What was it about those two men that found them at odds with each other?
Well, I think Cruz would say it wasn't personal with Cesar, but that it was an institutional division that needed to be respected, because when CRLA was first created, there was an agreement in its charter that said it would not represent the UFW as a union. And what that meant was that it could represent individual farm workers, but it couldn't really become, at the government's expense, the lawyers for the union itself. So Cesar had, you know, expectations that CRLA was there. There were a bunch of lawyers. Why wouldn't they do, you know, sort of what Cesar needed them to do? And a division, you know, essentially had to be drawn and it had to be respected.
So we fast forward to 1982. Governor Jerry Brown chooses Cruz Reynoso for the state Supreme Court. What was it about him that appealed to Jerry Brown, do you think?
Well, I think Jerry Brown was really committed to diversity on the court. And I think that Cruz was, in many ways, a fabulous choice. He had already been appointed to the California Court of Appeal. He'd been there for 4 years. He had distinguished himself as a judge. And I think it was a genuine commitment to both putting Cruz himself on, but also, you know, putting somebody of Latino background on that court at a time when this was the first Latino to be appointed.
And, of course, he serves for just 4 years before getting recalled in that 1986 recall election. Rose Byrd was the lightning rod in that election, of course, and the death penalty was ostensibly the reason. But as you point out in the film, it was really more complicated than that. There were other factors going on. Describe those, if you would.
Yes. Well, I think what happened in 1986 is that it was a perfect storm sort of on behalf of the right wing and against the progressive wing of the court. Rose Byrd had been hated for a long time by agribusiness and big business because the court's decisions, it was a very progressive court at the time, and its decisions were largely on behalf of, you know, consumers. There were product liability cases that were being upheld, and business was feeling that this court was, quote, unfriendly to them. And what ended up happening was that the business interests, who could never really go after the court kind of in their own name and on their own terms, were able to join with the pro-death penalty folks that, you know, Rose Byrd had spoken out against the death penalty. And that made her kind of a lightning rod, as you say, for those forces. But what happened was you had the additional business community lined up to with very deep pockets to help support that campaign. And I think what we saw in 1986, and part of the reason I think it was successful, is that it was one of the first direct mail, what I would call a right-wing campaign, against judges anywhere in the country. And it was very, I mean, I think people were caught off guard by it. And Cruz and Joe Groton, whose personal views on the death penalty were never sort of as strong or oppositional as Rose Byrd's were, essentially went down with a sinking ship.
Well, let's listen to another clip from the film. This is Cruz Reynoso kind of reflecting on his recall after the election in 1986.
The constitutional rulings, which in the past have been described as great rulings, rulings, for example, that protected the right of Japanese Americans to own land in California, rulings that protected the people of this state to be able to buy housing irrespective of race, are rulings that the Supreme Court issued at a time when public passion was against those feelings. Now we look back with great pride that the Supreme Court was courageous, that it stood for the Constitution, that it stood for equality. But I think we have to ask ourselves, how likely is that to happen if judges worry about whether their opinions are making powerful political or economic interests in this state happy or unhappy?
And Abby Ginsberg, of course, that question of judicial independence is still very much with us 25 years later. Looking back again on Cruz Reynoso's life, what's the lesson here, both in terms of his life as a judge and afterwards, because he went on to be on the Commission on Civil Rights and he got the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Bill Clinton. I mean, the election was not the end of his career by any means.
Absolutely not. And I think the fabulous thing about Cruz Reynoso is that what he says in the film is, you know, I saw this as political, not personal, and I didn't take it personally. And he understood that he was kind of caught in a political crossfire. And so what I would say one of the lessons is that, you know, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you keep on fighting. And that's really what he did. And the other thing I think he would say is that it is an obligation of every citizen to be involved in their community, in the issues of the day, and he is a role model for the rest of us because at 80, he's on, you know, six different commissions. He's still working very hard to make the world a better place and to fight against injustice.
All right. Abby Ginsberg is director of the new film Cruz Reynoso, Sowing the Seeds of Justice. It's airing on public television stations throughout the nation this month. Abby Ginsberg, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott.
And now the New Century Chamber Orchestra in San Francisco. It doesn't have nearly the profile of the city's renowned symphony or opera. But under its current music director, violinist Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg, the orchestra is becoming known as much for its visual style as its sound. Deirdre Kennedy reports.
Watching the New Century Chamber Orchestra perform is unlike any other symphony experience. As the 19 string musicians draw their bows, they bob and sway together like undulating waves. Musical director Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg.
One of the most unique features of this orchestra, the most unique feature, is their joy of playing. And that is what I think comes through not only in what you hear, but what you see.
Before joining New Century, Salerno-Sonnenberg had been a solo violinist for more than 30 years and played with some of the world's top orchestras. She says their job was to follow the conductor. But the New Century has no conductor, so the players have to give each other signals to stay in sync, play louder or slower.
I think it's necessary to be more physical. We're all sort of leading at the same time. Of course, yeah, I'm there and there, and I'm leading, but there are cues to be given to all kinds of things going on at any given second in any piece.
Part of what makes the orchestra such a well-oiled machine, she says, is its democratic way of interpreting each piece of music. Rehearsals can be quite a rowdy event.
Everyone's voice is heard musically, and everyone has a chance to share opinions, and, you know, we come to consensus.
Violinist Lynn Richburg has played with New Century since it began in 1992.
The group has grown, and the members have gotten to know each other, and we're friends, and, you know, we like each other, and we like playing together. And she's come with, just a real clear energy and vision of where to take the orchestra next.
Under Salerno-Sonnenberg, the orchestra has expanded its repertoire, taking on challenging works by Strauss and Bartok and premiering original pieces. Second violin Don Harms.
Well, we have more fun. We actually have more fun because before I felt like we were a classical ensemble. And, you know, especially the name, New Century Chamber Orchestra, it should be called the Wild New Century Chamber Orchestra or the Endless Possibility because there's so much with Nadja. She thinks way out of the box. She thinks world.
San Francisco music critic Joshua Cosman says having Salerno-Sonnenberg has finally brought New Century the recognition it has long deserved. As something of a rock star in the classical music world, she's drawn audiences to New Century who might never have heard them otherwise. And he says she's infused the orchestra with her famously passionate style.
Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg is an absolute fireball. She's not a clean and precise, elegant player. She's a wild and erotic, untrammeled kind of player. Certainly the playing is as precise and as unified and as focused as it's ever been, but there's also an element now of freedom and a kind of devil-may-care excitement about the performances that wasn't always there under some of her predecessors.
The New Century Chamber Orchestra kicks off its 20th anniversary season this weekend with shows in the Bay Area. For the California Report, I'm Deirdre Kennedy.
Whether or not you think we hit the right notes, tell us what you think about stories you hear on the California Report. Send your email to calreport@kqed.org. You can also comment on specific stories online. Just go to californiareport.org. While you're there, you'll see everything we archive. And if you feel like listening on your own time, check out our podcast. You can sign up for it at californiareport.org or look for us on iTunes. There's something about lakes and rivers that makes picking up a rock and skipping it along the surface almost irresistible. In the Sierra foothills, reporter Catherine Stifter went to the Yuba River looking for the perfect stone. And along the way, she learned some lessons about the environment and hydrodynamics.
There's the plink as the stone first hits the water. If you're lucky, the stone hops a few more times, ending with a handful of pity-pats.
Whoa, 19!
Here in Nevada County, stone skipping has come into its own as a sport.
We follow the rules of the Mackinac Island Stone Skipping and Kerplunking Club. Don't ask me what kerplunking means. No one knows.
That's John Leonard, self-proclaimed lifelong rock skipper, the brains behind the first annual Stone Skipping Championship that took place last weekend on the Yuba River outside of Nevada City.
Is there a better venue on the planet with the still waters of the Yuba? It's perfect.
Leonard says he created the contest as a way to have fun and raise money for the nonprofit river protection organization, the South Yuba River Citizens League. The contest was inaugurated during their annual River Cleanup Day earlier this month.
I thought it was a wonderful idea because it is a family-friendly event, and that's what we want to promote, that families can play together, work together, help out the community together.
At the end of every summer, Miriam LaMauve wrangles a cadre of volunteers to collect the cigarette butts, dirty diapers, tires, and even refrigerators that rivergoers leave behind.
And we are one of the many inland Sierra rivers that do a cleanup because 68% of the trash on the coast comes from inland sources. So that's why it's important to clean up before it even gets to the ocean. Over the 13 years now, we've hauled out over 126,000 pounds of trash and recycling with 5,500 volunteers.
LaMauve's gift for all that hard work has always been a celebratory after party. This year, complete with a stone skipping championship. There are trophies and prizes for kids and adults, but to win, says Todd Anderson, you gotta find the perfect stone.
You're trying to find something that's pretty smooth. In this kind of water, because it has a slight ripple to it, anything with an edge has a tendency to catch.
I think you're looking at the end of summer on a heavily trafficked beach that has been seriously picked over. So if somebody really wants to come down here and throw rocks, they're probably better off bringing their own.
I actually did. I found them this morning when I was cleaning up.
That's Matt Green from Nevada City.
Rounder the better. I like them when they're curved on the bottom, so they don't catch, and a little weight to them.
It's Matt's birthday. His family's watching, but he feels no pressure.
There is some thick competition. Confidence is moderate to good, I guess. You know, I'm just here to have fun. If I win, it's just icing on the cake.
Matt Green, age 36, from Nevada City.
The judges counted Matt's plinks and pity pats.
5, 6, 7. 7.
Each contestant throws 3 stones. There are no do-overs. Whoever skips the most wins.
Okay, Jeff, he's 55. Her score, 20.
That was the winning throw. 20 skips by Jeff Carver of Nevada City. By the way, there were actual kids in this competition, a dozen boys under the age of 18.
Next we have Brennan Sams, age 3. Oh my God, look at this young stud.
9-year-old Aiden Reedy Schneider skipped 12 times to take the youth category. Out of 38 contestants aged 3 to 65, there were just 2 women who were more brave than lucky. Maybe at next year's championship, we'll see more from the stone-skipping sisterhood. For the California Report, I'm Catherine Stifter on the Yuba River.
And finally, our show last week featured a story about Santa Barbara's Primo Boxing Club. It's kind of a haven for kids in a tough neighborhood. But the club has fallen on hard times and faces eviction. Well, after the story aired, listeners stepped in to help. One offered to pay the first few months' rent on a new space for the club. Owner Jean Pommier.
That was really, really exciting for us because at this point, we barely have anything left. So we're just going to move ahead as if we thought we had a future for Primo and hope that with that positive attitude, we actually will.
Jean and her husband Joe continue their search for a new home for Primo. If funding doesn't come through, the Pommiers face losing their own home as well. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen with help from David Marks. Our interns are Rigoberto Hernandez and Rebecca Wolfson. Our producer is Victoria Maleone. Craig Miller is the senior editor for Climate Watch. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.